Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Renee. Happy Wednesday. Today we are going to talk about Martin Luther King, somebody who was so far ahead of his time. Do you believe it was 50 years ago that he started talking about how we all needed to be better people and get along? And still, 50 years later, we are still so struggling. I don't get it. I really, really don't get it. It's a shame, because we should be listening. We should be paying attention to what he said. And I don't know why we're not. But we aren't. But I found some interesting things about Martin Luther King. And I'm gonna talk about some of those. But first, I want to talk about something personal in regard to the King family. In my tenure at the Institute, I met Coretta Scott King. I met Yolanda, Bernice, Martin III, and I met Dexter. All very, very, very nice people. However, as always, I had a favorite, and that was Yolanda. Yolanda, first of all, was close to my age when I met her. We were both in our early 50s, and she was so down to earth and so amazing. I remember one day I got a call that she was at a local hotel, and the boss wanted me to pick her up. So I took the van and I went over to pick her up, and she came running out with her own suitcases, put all of her, I went to get out of the van, she said, "Don't be silly, I can do this," and put all of her stuff in the van, and off we went. Totally down to earth and amazing about how she behaved and how she treated other people. She treated other people like they were her friends. And that's really all we all need, isn't it? Is being treated like we're friends. And of course, it's everything that her father was trying to establish. Coretta, when I met her, very sweet, very gentle lady. But when I really got to know her was when she was already ailing. So even though we had some nice private moments, she was struggling with lots of things, so the conversations didn't get too deep. However, with Yolanda had written a book. And, you know, I looked all over for it, and I remembered that I lent it to someone, so it's not here in my library at home. But she came in my office to tell me that that she had a book that she had written, and she wanted to give me one and sign it. Well, I was, you know, ecstatic about that, and she did so. But while she's doing that, while she is looking, you know, writing in the book and everything and handing it to me, I said, "Gosh, it must be so hard to follow in the footsteps of somebody like Martin Luther King. I mean, how many people in the world, I don't know this count, I guess I should have to look it up, that were given, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize." But she looked at me and sat down in a chair and got real, you know, kind of sad looking. And I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Nobody's ever said that to me before. Renee, you have no idea." And when I turned the back of the book, I don't know what you call that part that you do like a little summary in the back of the book, it said, you know, "It's a tough road following in the footsteps of my mother and father." And indeed it is, because, you know, when you're following in footsteps like that, everybody figures you're going to do the same thing, be the same person, have the same answers, say the same things. And that's not always true, and certainly not always easy. So, again, Coretta passed, and very shortly after that, I was getting ready to go to work, and I heard it on the morning news and thought it was a mistake because she was so vital, Yolanda was. But Yolanda passed very soon after Coretta did. So I do, however, want to talk today about what it was he was trying to get everybody to understand. First, I want to bring in Shelley. Good morning, Miss Shelley. How are you?
Good morning, Rita. I was having a hard time dialing in this morning. I couldn't get an antenna. I called in like several times, and I kept getting such static that I couldn't even hear you, so I kept hanging up, and then finally I got through, I think, on the fourth time.
Well, that is kind of weird, because that's the same thing that was happening to me. I got in just in time, just before the bell, so to speak, and because my computer was moving slow, and could have been me that was moving slow, but we'll blame it on the computer.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, anyway, I'm here now, though. So I guess you read his his speech then at the start of the show, I'm assuming, right?
No, I did not. I've only been on a few minutes, but what I talked about in the beginning of the show is the fact that I do want to give a little bit of a bio about him. And because I think everybody knows the speech, but I don't know if everybody knows where he came from and the different things that he did. And I found it very interesting. But I did talk about the fact that all of the King family, aside from Martin, had been at the Institute, and how we got to know Coretta when she was, got to know her the best when she was very ill.
Right.
And I talked about Yolanda and everything. So I'm going to start this, and I'm going to peruse it a little bit while I'm reading, but most of it is very interesting. He was born January 15th in 1929 on April 4th. And born in January 1929 on April 4th. Can you tell that I'm maybe not awake yet? He was born on January 15th in 1929, and he was laid to rest on April 4th in 1968. Gosh, that was such a long time ago, you know, and everything he said was so right on for today. He was born Michael Luther King Jr., but later had his name changed to Martin. His grandfather began the family's long tenure as pastors of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, serving from 1914 to 1931. His father had served from then until present, and from 1960 until his death, Martin Luther King acted as co-pastor. Martin Luther attended segregated public schools in Georgia, graduating from high school at the age of 15. Wow. He received the BA degree, Bachelor of Arts degree, in 1948 from the Morehouse College, a distinguished Negro institution of Atlanta, from which both his father and grandfather had graduated. After 3 years of theological study at Crozer Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, where he was elected president of a predominantly white senior class, he was awarded the BD in 1951. With a fellowship won at Crozer, he enrolled in a graduate study at Boston University, completing his residence for the doctorate in 1953 and receiving the degree in 1955. So on top of everything else, he must have been incredibly smart. I mean, smart, smart. So in Boston, he met and married Coretta Scott, a young woman of uncommon intellectual and artistic attainments. Two sons and two daughters were born into the family. In 1954, Martin Luther King became the pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. Always a strong worker for civil rights for members of his race, King was, by this time, a member of the executive committee of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Gosh, it seems so long ago when we referred to black people as colored people, doesn't it? It doesn't even sound right saying that. The leading organization of its kind in the nation. He was ready then, early in December 1955, to accept the leadership of the first great Negro nonviolent demonstration of contemporary times in the United States. The bus boycott described by Gunner John in his presentation speech in honor of the laureate. The boycott lasted 382 days. I didn't know that. On December 21st, 1956, the Supreme Court of the United States had declared unconstitutional the laws requiring segregation on buses. Negroes and whites rode the buses as equals. During these days of boycott, King was arrested, his home was bombed, he was subjected to personal abuse, but at the same time he emerged as a Negro leader of the first rank. In 1957, he was elected president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization formed to provide new leadership for the now burgeoning civil rights movement. That was a scary time. I remember that very well, all those times. The ideals for this organization he took from Christianity. His operational techniques from Gandhi. In the 11-year period between 1957 and 1968, King traveled over 6 million miles and spoke over 2,500 times.
Wow.
Appearing wherever there was any kind of injustice, protest, and action. And meanwhile, he wrote 5 books as well as numerous articles. In these years, he led a massive protest in Birmingham, Alabama. That caught the attention of the entire world, providing what he called a coalition of conscience. That word is always so hard for me to say, conscience, when I read it. I can say it when I'm not reading it. When I read it, for some reason, I mess it up. And inspiring his letter from the Birmingham jail, a manifesto of the Negro Revolution. He planned the drives in Alabama for the registration of Negroes as voters. Gosh. He directed the peaceful march on Washington, D.C. of 250,000 people to whom he delivered his address, I Have a Dream. He conferred with President John F. Kennedy and campaigned for President Lyndon B. Johnson. He was arrested upwards of 20 times and assaulted at least 4 times. He was awarded 5 honorary degrees, was named Man of the Year by Time Magazine in 1963, and became not only the symbolic leader of the American blacks, but also a world figure. At the age of 35, Martin Luther King was the youngest man to have received the Nobel Peace Prize. When notified of his selection, he announced that he would turn over the prize money of $54,123 to the furtherance of the civil rights movement. On the evening of April 4th, 1968, while standing on the balcony of his motel room in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was to lead a protest march in the sympathy with striking garbage workers of that city, he was assassinated. So it's kind of a scary thing when you realize that somebody who did everything without violence spoke his truth, and still somebody found him intimidating enough to take his life.
Well,
it's
they didn't
thing.
Find him himself intimidating. They found what he was trying to do unacceptable to them, and that comes from hatred and bigotry. And his whole message is what you and I talk about. It's all about unification. It's about not looking at somebody's outward appearance or their religion or their sexual orientation, just looking at the heart and soul of the person. What are their ideals? What do they talk about? Are they interesting to you? If they're not, leave them alone. If they are, talk to them. I mean, life is really not more complicated than that, but we make it more complicated by that, by putting our own likes and dislikes on other people. And if they don't have the same, for some reason, they're not good people just because they're different. And all he was trying to do was get people to unite, regardless of their color, regardless of their religion, regardless of any of their descriptive attributes. just for people to love people for being a co-human being, so to speak. You know, and it was really, that's why his message is so powerful today, because it's timeless. That would work thousands of years ago, and that would work thousands of years into the future. It really is a timeless message that he had. But it's very threatening to people that have grown up being taught fear and isolation, and our kind of people are the only good kind of people, you know, and we're all mm-hmm. of a sudden now separate from other human beings because you look different or have a different religion. And that's just utter nonsense, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are people in every walk of life, in every race, in every religion, in every ethnicity that really live by the words that Martin Luther King spoke. In fact, I think probably most of the world is. Unfortunately, the ones that make the news and the ones that get all the notoriety are the ones that don't want that, that don't want people uniting, that want separatism. I believe it's the smaller part of the population, but it's the one that is violent and gets in the news a lot. But I think most people recognize that we are supposed to care about each other, and I think that's why your show and messages like this are so powerful, and why they remain powerful for decades and decades.
Well, I think that on top of that, for some reason, well, it's a lot about interpretation, like we've talked about many, many times. And I hear quotations like an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, constantly. In other words, if you're mean to me, I'm going to be mean to you. If you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you worse, is that interpretation. And that's not what was meant. It's for me, it symbolizes a sense of fairness, not a sense of how to turn that around and hurt each other. It's a sense of fairness. What is good for me is good for you is another one. It's all about a sense of fairness. I'm going to read this. I hope I can do it some justice, but I think many of us, even though we may have heard it back in 1968, is that right? No, 1963, I think he read. Yeah, today in 1963. So, I'm going to read it, and maybe it'll be a good thought for all of us to carry throughout the day and carry it into the rest of our life. Maybe this is something we should hear on a regular basis, somebody talking about the truth. I'm happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. 50 years ago, a great American, in whose symbolic shadow we stand today, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree became as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had just been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself an exile in his own land. And we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black man as well as white man, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that the America has defaulted on this promissory note, insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so, we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us, upon demand, the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind the American of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the movement. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until there is invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. And those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. And there will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But there is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have become to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied as long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating, for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no. We are not satisfied. And we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells, and some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom, left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi, go back to Alabama, go back to South Carolina, go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana, go back to the slums and the ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends. And so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious racist, and its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right here in Alabama, little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and little white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope, and this is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair and a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful sympathy of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. And this will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountain side let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, Let freedom ring from the Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village, every hamlet, every state, and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. That was much tougher for me to get through than I thought it was going to be. Amazing, huh? I think I've lost Shelley.
No, you haven't lost me. You haven't lost me.
Okay.
Yeah, that was much more emotional for me than I had recalled. I haven't heard that in a while.
A couple of times you
paused, and when you paused, I was being extremely emotional myself. I was like, wow, this is hitting really the way it's hitting me. It's very, very powerful.
Well, you know why? Because it's the truth. The truth is what is amazing. The truth is what puts us in a place that you can't ignore. There's something so powerful about the truth.
That's right.
And even when people want to deny it, people want to slander it, people want to say, that's bullshit, I don't need to do that, or I don't need to make everybody my friend, or everybody in this world is in it for themselves, and this is all about what's in it for me. But when you really hear the truth, put eloquently, with heart, how can you deny it? You can't deny the truth. You might not like it. It might not be the way you think things should be, but you really can't deny it because the truth is the truth. And that's the point he was trying to make. The point he was trying to make was, this is what you said would happen. You didn't say, by the way, you don't have to be slaves anymore, but the only people that are ever going to be large and in charge are white.
That's true. That's right.
You know, nobody ever said that. Nobody ever said that. Nobody actually ever said Adam and Eve were white, for God's sakes, if that's what you believe. Whatever you believe, you have to believe, if you just look around us. How many times have we talked about how different we all are? How many times have we talked about how different we all behave, how different things make us happy, how different things make us sad. There's nothing the same, really, about any of us. And to
think... Well, the funny thing about it is, people, if you look at most of the depictions of Jesus, he's white, he's Caucasian. Yet, if you think about the area in the world where he was born and grew up, they were all olive-skinned.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then a lot of people have bigotry against olive colored skinned people. And that is more than likely, in fact, there are some depictions of him that he was dark eyed and olive skinned. And there's some, old transcripts that have been found and stuff. But it's like, who cares? His message is timeless. Martin Luther King's message is timeless. Who cares what the person looked like that said it? The words themselves, like you said, are the truth, have deep meaning. The reason you got emotional while you were reading it, and the reason I got emotional while I was hearing it, is because it goes to our core. It goes to our emotional sensitivities. And whenever you inspire love, love equates to truth. Hate is what's deceptive, and people that allow themselves to feel hate or distrust or to feel fear of other people, for no reason I'm talking about, all right? Not
mm-hmm.
that somebody's
mm-hmm.
watching you and you can tell that they're menacing. But, I mean, just to hate someone or fear someone because they're different, it goes against our nature. It goes against who we are as people. We are spiritual beings, and we were created out of love, and love, there's the only truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's the truth. And like I said, that's the whole point. It's about what's true, what rings true, what sounds true, what you know to be true, whether you're in denial or not. You know it to be true. It's, you know, the word right, too. How do people think about their own personal rights? Your own personal rights shouldn't infringe on someone else's rights. Otherwise, nobody's got rights, right? I mean, you know, that sounds kind of silly, but if you have your rights and I have my rights, I don't have any right to infringe on your rights because they're your rights. And that seems to be one of our biggest downfalls is somehow thinking that we get to a place where we're above other people's rights, the right for them to be treated nicely, the right for them to have the same opportunities that you have. Those are their rights. I think sometimes there's a misconception about what rights are as well. Rights for me are the things that you can take on personally, that you take care of. Rights are not a cherry on top of your sundae. They're actually a part of your workload. They're actually a part of your everyday struggle to become a good person, your rights. Your rights shouldn't set you above anybody else. They should help make you who you are, and that should be somebody who is righteous, somebody who cares, somebody who doesn't just do everything in an effort to make sure that they're the only one benefiting.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the whole thing, look at the struggle of women. The struggle of women is so parallel to the struggle of blacks because, again, mm-hmm. we have the people in power who for a long time were men lording their rights over us as if they were different than our rights, as if they had rights that superseded ours. And women, for a very long time, were treated as second-class citizens. So women are really in a position to understand more about what blacks have gone through because on some level, generationally, women were actually persecuted. And, they didn't get jobs that they were more qualified for. They didn't get pay that they were more qualified for. You know, women didn't even have the right to vote. So on many levels, there's a huge parallel there. You know,
well, for sure there is. Well, and imagine the white woman, for God's sakes. I mean, she had like a double whammy.
You mean a black woman?
Yeah, a white woman? Yeah, well, you know, I've got myself in quite a state right now. I read this last night and thought to myself, I can do this, even though it was emotional last night. But today it was like, holy cow. I felt like I was, you know, like when I've read when I write something for funerals, you know, and it's always so much about the person and stuff like that, and I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, that's the Irish in me, everybody. You know, we get emotional. But black woman, it was hard to read some of those things, again, because it's so right on, and it really, really hits home with me.
Yeah.
Really hits home with me, because I actually suffer a real indignancy from the way some people think. And some of them are people I love. It's not like it's people that I don't like, because them I don't care about. The ones that hurt you the worst that think small-minded are the ones you care about. And when you think you've met somebody who is different and is caring and is trying to make a difference, all of a sudden something happens and you see more often than not that truly it's all about them. mm-hmm. when they can give and when they can be there for you and when they can do this and it's convenient for them and it somehow serves them a little bit, it's always wonderful. But you can count on one hand how many people you know, if you were in trouble, who would put you first.
That's true.
And that's sad. It's so sad. Because it means at the end of the day, we're all so freaking self-centered that some things will never change, Shelley. Some things will never, ever change. Because our own comfort, our own well-being, our own, I don't know, our own place is the most important to us, no matter what.
Right.
I mean, monetarily,
we are, as a species, as a civilization, as a society, I think we are going through major shifts, which is why you're seeing such extremes on our planet right now. You're seeing extremes of violence and depravity, and you're also seeing extremes of just amazing random acts of kindness and compassion, and you're really seeing the opposite ends of the spectrum in the news right now and hearing all these stories. So I think as a people, we are elevating ourselves, and whenever there are drastic changes like that, people that are, emotionally lazy are threatened by it. And I think that's where a lot of the turmoil is coming from, because people are aware that something is shifting, something is changing, and there's a lot of people that are going for the ride and are exhilarated by it and saying, wow, the winds of change are finally coming across our planet, and this is a great thing. And there's other people that don't want the status quo being messed with. And they're grappling and fussing and fighting and trying to keep things where they were. But I do think that as a people, and I'm talking about humans, I'm not talking about any ethnicity or religion, I'm talking about us as human beings globally. I think that globally, human beings are going through a positive shift. And it's gonna take a few years for the dust to settle and see where we end up.
Well, in my heart, I absolutely, positively want to agree with everything you just said, because it sounds wonderful and it sounds like the way it's supposed to be. But then I peruse in the afternoon and look at everything that's online. I read more about Edward Snowden, who made a, he did this to be, I don't know, he did this to achieve notoriety, he did this to do something, but none of it was, didn't come from any kind of integrity. I'm sorry. I've read everything now about him. Part of me was torn because you know me, I feel like everybody deserves the benefit of the doubt. But he did this out of meanness, and he didn't do it to help anybody. He did it to hurt people, which seems to be one of the biggest driving forces out there that we have to contend with all the time. Let me see how much I can shock you, hurt you, or rock your world. Well, we don't need that. We need people that are going to do things that are beneficial to our world, that are going to be beneficial to us personally. And then, uh-huh. like, the waters, not starting more turmoil. I think decisions made by people who have too many responsibilities are often bad ones, because a lot of times they're made out of fear. Every time I do something, every decision I've ever made, because I felt like I was under the gun, directing myself from some kind of fear or worry, it's been a wrong one. It's been a wrong one every time. Even if I can tell myself that it was the only thing I could do, I didn't know what else to do, I did what I thought I had to do. How many times have you done that, Shelley, in your life?
Mm-hmm.
So many.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, I will ponder a decision for a while, and I think of all the different outcomes, and I'm not... there are times that I'm spontaneous, but even when I'm spontaneous, I'll slam the brake on momentarily and kind of look at the situation and then kind of jump in. I really think things through, and I try to imagine how what I'm going to say or what I'm going to do is going to impact the other person. And for me, my life has been easier because I've been that way. I mean, you used to joke about what your sister Barbara said about, you know, about, oh, my God, that just takes too much effort or too much time or something like that. But for me, it's actually made my life easier by contemplating things that way and considering how my actions or words are going to impact somebody else. You know, because for the most part, and not that I haven't made mistakes, and not that I haven't spoken out of turn, I mean, I am human, but for the most part, I don't have to deal with those backlashes because I have put out a little bit of, you know, thought before I jumped in into something, especially something where you could be affecting masses, like this guy Snowden you're talking about. I mean, you know, he puts this out there without a solution. What was the point? Because like you said, yeah, he didn't really help anybody the way he did it. He didn't really think that through. You know, if he was trying to do this to be helpful, he didn't hit the mark the way he handled it.
Well, but that's the point I'm making. I think what you're talking about is when you make a decision, you think about it and you think about the repercussions and all that kind of stuff. That's the way you should be. And and you, Shelley, your middle name should be Analyzation anyway. We know that about you.
So, right.
Reality, right? But I'm talking about when you're running under the momentum of fear.
Right.
And then it's different. I mean, I think I've made lots of great decisions for other people, for myself. I, you know, if I blow my own horn, I think I've done a lot of good things for a lot of different people. I've settled them. I've calmed them. It's one of my gifts, and I know that I can do that. I'm talking about the decisions you make when you're afraid. When you're afraid to not hurry up and make a decision, to not hurry up and fix everything because you're under the gun. Those are the kind of decisions that are usually wrong and usually cause more harm than good. However, I think that there's always a little fear in any decision you make that you know, is for throngs of people. But I'm saying that when people get scared, when there's all these innuendos out there and they're trying to, number one, cover their own butt, number two, keep themselves and the people that they love out of harm's way, then they're running under the energy of fear. And you make bad decisions then. I think
right.
One of the things, we have a very dear friend I never can remember how she puts it, but something about worrying is like, you know, setting up the stage to have everything happen bad.
Right.
It's not what she says, but you've heard her say that before. Gee, say things like that. Worry is, there's something that she says all the time, and I think to myself, God, I wish I could exercise that more. Because
yeah.
I do fret and worry about a lot of different things, and they don't, very often don't even pertain to me.
Right.
So
right.
I do
worrying is sort of what's the word I'm trying to think of? It's an emotion that doesn't serve us, for lack of a better way of putting it. Because when you worry about things, like you said, a lot of times people worry about things that either, number one, are completely out of their control, so what's the point anyway,
mm-hmm.
or something that probably is not really realistic that it's going to take place, whether it's in their family or their community or worldwide or something like that. And the bottom line is when you worry, that is a negative emotion. That does things that's not good to us just physically and emotionally. you know, and it kind of tears us down. And then especially if you're in a state of worrying and then you have to make decisions on top of that, going back to what you said a few minutes ago, you put yourself in a position where you're not going to make clear decisions. You're not going to make good decisions if you keep yourself in that state of fretting and worrying, you know. So there is a way of getting over it. There's all kinds of emotional techniques we've discussed on the show before, like tapping and stuff like that. But worrying really, really is a very, very detrimental emotion, and I don't think people wrap their brains around how much it can make your thought processes dysfunctional, because it keeps you in a state of lack of clarity. So when you're worrying too much, you're not really assessing situations for what they are. You're assessing situations for what you fear they may become. And when you go there, you can actually inspire those negative outcomes to happen. Where if you look at it more from a stance of, okay, this is a possibility, but how do I prevent that? Or how do I move forward in a positive way? And if you shift it to a positive way, a lot of times you'll feel calmer, you'll feel a little bit more in control, and you'll regain a little bit of clarity on the situation. But people have to really put the effort out of getting them out of that fear mode or that worry mode, because you can't think clearly when you're in that state, and you should never make a decision, especially a decision that's going to affect a lot of people, until you've calmed yourself, centered yourself, and make sure you got that little spark of clarity before you jumped forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, but all of those things mean that you are, you know, you're pretty much in charge of your feelings and your direction. Those things are not so easy to accomplish when you're not at that place, when you're not in that zone of being able to say, okay, Rini, calm yourself down now. You know that this is what you should be doing and doing and
right.
Everything. That, those places are good places. I'm just talking about our government and this Snowden guy, some of the things that they did. And every time about the fact that there is in the wind change. And I feel it as well. But then I read all these things that are going on there in the outside world. I mean, there's been a case on the internet for weeks about some teenagers that lured an ex-boyfriend of one of the girls into a house and beat him, shot him, and then burnt up his body.
Oh my
and they
God.
Were like
wow.
16, 17, 18 years old, and you know, I read stuff like that, and I think to myself, what in the hell is going on? And maybe that's the answer. Hell is going on. Maybe that's the answer. Maybe some people, you know, when you turn right to do the right thing, a lot of other people turn left. So it's. I realize that no matter what changes take place, there will always be good and there will always be evil. I get all that. But what I don't get is how even the people that do such foolish things are almost always someplace in there looking for the good in their life and looking for the happiness in their life and looking for a place to feel safe and loved. I cannot believe, unless they're like another thing that we've talked about recently, mentally deranged, psychotic, or some of the horrible things that can happen to people when there's a disconnect in their brain and... But that's a whole other different category. But everyday people that get up every morning and put their shoes and socks on like everybody else should want the chaos and the discord and the hatred to stop. I can't believe that they wouldn't want it to. But yet you still see it being formulated by some of those same people who think they are good and gracious. They are
right.
Still out there stupid, wrong things and hurting other people. Right? I mean, we see it every day.
Of course. You know, and
so
a lot, some of it's out of fear, Some of it's out of worry. Some of it's out of people thinking that they need to act a particular way because they're trying to preserve their way of life. And for some, to me it's absurd, but for some absurd reason, they feel that other people becoming successful or gaining more rights or being more equal to them is going to somehow affect their ability to maintain their lifestyle, which is utter nonsense. Because the more people that are happy, the more people that are given opportunities, the more people that can experience success and being treated with dignity, it elevates us as a people. It's not going to create lack for others. It's going to end up creating more abundance for everybody. You know, we've talked on the show before about there's millionaires and billionaires out there. The money is there. It's just being grappled up by the wrong people. But if you were to have the masses start gaining a little bit more respect for themselves and moving in that direction, there would be a leveling off. It wouldn't happen overnight, but it would eventually happen. And people have to stop fearing allowing equality to rise up and to have true respect for everybody and realize that it's not going to diminish you in any way by opening the doors and just allowing people to rise up and to really go after their potentials.
Well, and maybe that's something that we need to talk about every day a little bit, especially now that we've got the show in the morning. I think maybe every day we need to do something that is positive and makes people understand that positivity is of their own making. And every day you have the opportunity to be different than you were yesterday. If yesterday wasn't so hot and you know in your own heart that you were not the best person that you know how to be yesterday, then today you have another opportunity. You have another opportunity to make things better, make things happier for yourself and the people that are around you, and make the changes that you think are needed to make. If you don't want to take on the whole world, take on your own world.
Right.
If we each fix our own world, things will be better already. It's like fixing our own self. But a lot of us, I don't ever think in terms of just Rainey, because I have a family and because I've been a matriarch, if you will, for my whole life. I don't know anything different. And it's hard for me to just centralize all of my hopes and dreams and projects and anything I want to do to just be about Rainey. That's not really something I know how to do, to be honest with you. But I do believe that when I make decisions that make my world better, it rubs off on the people that I'm close to and makes their worlds a little bit better, too. So I think it's a good thing. But from now on in the mornings, we're going to talk. We'll talk about all the issues that we talk about all the time because I think it's important for people to be informed, and I think it's good to have discussions because if somebody reads the newspaper and gets all upset about something, a lot of times if we air it and talk about it and kind of extinguish it a little bit, then it's good for other people. But every day I want to start on a good note, and I'm going to end today by saying that everybody has an opportunity today to make much better than any day prior, much better than any day. And take that opportunity and use it and put yourself in a better place and make yourself understand that as long as you're walking and talking and can sit up and pay attention, you have an opportunity to make everything better than the way it is right this minute to the next minute. And it's your chance, it's your show, so go out there and show everybody how you can dance. That's what everybody needs to do every single day. So, thanks, Shell. I will see you 8:30 or 9. What's easier for you?
How about 8:45?
Perfect.
Right
see
in the
you
middle.
Then.
Is that cool? Yeah. Yeah,
see you
I'll
then.
Be here at 8:30 then. Yes, I'll see you at 8:30. I'll see you at 8:45.
Okay, perfect. 8:45. Okay, everybody, have the best day you can possibly have. We love you. Talk to you tomorrow morning. Bye-bye.
Bye, Rainey. Goodbye,
bye,
everyone.
Jill.